Hey, so I'm Lonnie Jarrett. It's great to be here. I really appreciate the New England School allowing me to teach and inviting me here and being very gracious hosts. And I started studying pulse diagnosis in 1980, and I've paid a lot of attention to it since then. I've been in full-time practice for 30 years, and pulse is a mystery to me. So I think the longer you do it and the more you know about Chinese medicine, and the longer you do it, the more you're impressed by the infinite depth of the medicine. So it's my estimation and several of my colleagues, and by my colleagues I mean scholars in the field who've been practicing 30, 40 years, that Chinese medicine is in a very interesting place. On the one hand, it's reaching a unique point of acceptance in Western culture, but that isn't necessarily on the terms of the principles of the medicine that we practice. It's being integrated, it's being assimilated into a Western paradigm, a Western cultural structure of evidence-based medicine, insurance, standardized testing, and those kind of mechanisms tend to turn medicine into what Clear Channel is to music, which is just like the same top 40 hits over and over with a reduced iconography and a simplicity that really isn't true to the mystery at the heart of the medicine, or the real strength of the medicine in terms of complementing what's Western medicine, which is really a biological, physical, and physiological medicine, much more about the external dimension of things. Chinese medicine is much more about the internal dimension of things. So my estimation, and the estimation of people I write articles with, like Zev Rosenberg, who was the herb teacher at PCOM, the dean of herbs at PCOM for 25 years, and is quite a profound scholar of the medicine, is that the areas that education is most lacking are pulse diagnosis, understanding the classics of the medicine, and having at least a fundamental understanding of the language. So pulse is one of the three pillars here. I think that is being given short shrift, and it's a bit of a difficult situation because we would love to see the classics and the language and pulse taught in all the schools, and yet who would teach them? Because there aren't that many people who really have an in-depth understanding which would be sufficient to teach the material in a semester-long or two- or three-year-long course. So a lot of this information has to be sought out postgraduate. And that's not a problem at all, as long as people do it. And you're the people who are doing it because you're here today. So that's fantastic. So what I'm going to endeavor to do is give you a very strong introductory foundation in the pulse. Taking a two-day class on the pulse would be like taking a two-day class on piano, right? Or a violin or a guitar. So it would be like, well, there are six strings, and there are 23 or 24 frets, and these are the names of the strings, and this is how to play Blowing in the Wind, or Kumbaya, or something like that. And of course, you can intuit, well, this is great, and you'll intuit a greater and a deeper depth. I'm actually going to give you enough this weekend that if you learned it, you could put a good 5 years solid in, 40 hours a week to get it. So I'm going to be, but there's a lot more than what I'm teaching. So there are different systems of pulse. This two main systems of pulse that I learned, one is the Nanjing system, and the Nanjing system is the main system that you all learned. To any degree, you learned pulse. So you learned that the left distal position is heart, small intestine. Then you have the middle position is liver and gallbladder, and the proximal position is kidney and bladder. And on the right side, you've got lungs and colon, stomach, spleen. And then depending on your tradition, either heart protector, three heater, or kidney yang. And that system's from the Nanjing. And it's basically a system of meridian energetics. It's a system of the circulation of qi in the Chinese clock. Just grab a seat, Robin. You can sit right up front here so I can see your beautiful smiling face. You can sit there too. Robin and I were standing at a bus stop in 1980, and there was a little thing that said 10-week acupuncture course, and she tore it off and said, "Let's do this. This sounds interesting." And that's where it all began. And then we sat around, at the end of the last day of class, we sat around Emily Dickinson's grave, doing like each person would stand up and talk, and the teachers would say, "Well, what's their color, what's their sound, what's their odor and emotion?" And I got everybody's right. And I was like totally shocked. And I was like, uh-oh. And then I was on the hook. And that's when I decided to go into the medicine. So it's lovely to see you. It's very nice. So we're just doing an intro. I'm just giving an intro here on pulse. So the Nanjing pulse system really tells you about relative excess and deficiency on the pulse. It allows you to assess what are called exit and entry blocks, which are blocks between successive channels on the pulse where qi isn't transferring. So, for instance, if you start the flow of qi at the lungs, to the colon, to the stomach, to spleen, to heart, etc., if you have a block between two organs, for instance, let's say liver is very strong but lung is very weak, then you can do liver 14, lung 1. So there are three entry-exit blocks on the head, three on the chest, and the Nanjing pulse system is basically good for that, and it's good for excess and deficiency between elements. So it allows you to design transfers. So if you see that wood is very strong and fire is very weak, then you could do liver 1 and heart 9, wood within wood and wood within fire, to transfer qi from wood to fire. If you saw that earth was very strong and water was very weak, you might do kidney 3 to bring the excess, relative excess from earth into water. So the Nanjing pulse system is very good for those kinds of reading excess and deficiency on the pulse and discerning entry-exit blocks. And that's all it's good for. It doesn't make any sense physiologically. It's a force fit to the five-element system. I call it a force fit because it should be apparent that if we divide the three pulse positions, distal, middle, and proximal, up and call them the three heater, then the distal position would be the upper heater, the middle position is the middle heater, and the proximal position is the lower heater, and it should be intuitively obvious that the small intestine and large intestine are not in the upper chow, right? And the heart protector and three heater aren't in the lower chow. Okay? So the Nanjing system is a good system for meridian energetics and relative excesses and deficiencies between the organs and the elements. And that's what it's excellent for, but that's all it does. And it's not really very good physiologically in terms of the actual positions of the organs in the body. And it really isn't that useful for designing an herbal diagnosis or formula. So it's not very useful for that. So the main system that I'm going to teach you this weekend, I learned from Leon Hammer and John Shen, his teacher. John Shen was my herbalist for years. I only took one course with him, which he basically spent the whole time telling stories about how great he was traveling through Asia and handling all the hard cases from town to town. And he would say, there was this young child dying of diarrhea. Can anyone guess what I did? And I said, well, you filled the belly button with salt and burned moxa on it. And he'd look at me and wince and go, no. I grilled salt on the stove and put the hot salt on their belly. It's like, thank you, Dr. Shen. So Dr. Shen was quite an enigma, but he was a genius. And I met Leon Hammer when I was in acupuncture school. And Leon is 91 now and still, he doesn't really practice, but he writes every day. I had lunch with him a month ago, and he said that he figures he has about half his life's work done by now. So I met him in acupuncture school, and when I graduated, I studied with him for 10 years, apprenticed with him, followed him around his clinic, and I ran all his teachings out of my office. And back then, he only taught a beginning and an advanced weekend, so I took them 20 times. And then since 95, I've been on my own with this stuff, and I'm teaching you my synthesis of the work I learned from Dr. Shen and from Leon. That work is available in a beautiful book called The Handbook of Contemporary Pulse Diagnosis, which is about $32. You can get it through Red Wing. There's a much bigger book that Leon wrote that's like 900 pages, but it's out of print. And when books go out of print, these opportunists sell them on Amazon for $600. So if you go on Amazon looking for his book and it's $600, that's the wrong book. And I wouldn't buy it because they'll release it electronically sooner or later. And that'll actually, it's only a reference text anyway, so that will be fine. But I would advise that if you're intrigued by what I teach this weekend, that you pick up the handbook and read through the handbook. And it would have been great if I had had that when I started. Because after studying with Leon for 6 years, he would mention something about a pulse position, and I and the other students would look at him and he'd go, what? I'd go, Leon, you've never mentioned this before. He'd go, really? So now you have it all in one very concise place. So why would we want to learn the pulse? Why is the pulse important? The Nanqing tells us the highest diagnosis is to look and to know. And that's something we can aspire to over many, many years if we practice in the right way with right intention. If we cultivate, after decades, we can just look and know. So usually the patient walks in the door and I've written down the herbs I'm going to give and the acupuncture points I'm going to do. And I just spend the rest of my time with them just trying to disprove that or see if anything else is, did I miss anything? Or is there some compelling reason not to do it? Because you just look and you go, oh, that's Gui Bi Tong. Oh, that's Jia Wei Gui Bi Tong. Oh, that's spleen 21, spleen 3, heart 1, heart 7, CV15. You just look and you know, because by the time you've done, tens of thousands of sessions, the patterns start to emerge and you can just see clearly. It would be like a wine expert tasting wine. They can take one sip and talk to you about it for 20 minutes. Right? Same kind of thing. But to do that, we have to cultivate right intention. So the capacity to look and know, we can say, is coming from our capacity to assimilate very quickly changing waveforms. So color, sound, odor, emotion as vehicles for spirit are very, very quickly changing waveforms. The most quickly changing waveform you can physically touch is the pulse. So the hara changes subtly, but you wouldn't put a needle in someone and expect their entire hara to be a different conformation, but you can literally put a needle in someone, predict a change on the pulse, and see the entire pulse change in exactly the way you predict. So when I treat patients, I have an expectation, and I put a needle in, and I take the pulse, and I put a needle in, and I'm going back to the pulse after every needle or every couple of needles, to see if things are going and the qi is flowing in exactly the way I want, which lets me know that the treatment is happening. Another reason we, so, so what pulse, so The pulse is the quickest changing waveform, and what you're doing is you're physically touching spirit. There is, of course, a technical aspect to pulse, and there's an intellectual aspect to pulse. And beyond, but all technique and all knowledge serve self-cultivation and they serve spirit. So what we're actually doing when we take pulse is we're listening. And listening implies small intestine 19, listening palace, and the ears, the capacity to listen, is that outer orifice goes directly into the heart, right? So the ear goes to the small intestine, and the small intestine is the closest minister to the heart. And it's the small intestine's job to sort out what is true, what is not true, what is real, what is not real, what is self, what is not self. And we can do that just talking to a person and just sitting with a person and just feeling spirit and feeling the impediments within the person, wind, cold, damp, heat, blood stagnation, qi deficiency. All of these are physiological metaphors for what's in the way obscuring the conductance of light through the vehicle of this person's mind and body into the world. And that light enters the world through the person's mind and body as virtue, as the Confucian virtues. So for water, wisdom, for wood, humility, benevolence, for fire, propriety, for earth, integrity, and reciprocity, and for metal, righteousness. And even though we can name those as individual virtues, that's like naming the colors of a rainbow. And even though we can put a crystal up, shine the sun through it, and see, you know, purple and blue and red and green and yellow and all those colors, we're still aware that those are distinctions, but it's all one light and all one light source. And similarly, all the virtues we see coming through a person are all one light, and all of the syndrome patterns and all of the stagnations and anything that isn't moving and being conducted is a physiological metaphor for an impediment to the conductance of light through the mind and through the body as vehicles for the transmission of light into the world. And we can feel that through our fingertips. So we do a 30 or 45 minute or an hour long diagnosis. So when a patient comes to me, I don't have them fill out any forms other than signing and an informed consent form. They sit and I ask them questions, and that could take anywhere from 30 minutes to generally 45 minutes. So that gives me the background of the person's life, and they're giving me the plot of their life. They're telling me the plot. This happened, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened. And the plot is the vehicle for the theme. Philosophically, the theme of life is destiny, its purpose. The why did they incarnate, what are they to do here, and to what degree are they doing it? So philosophically, it's destiny, and medically, it's expressed as an organ system, which is their constitutionally weak organ system, that defines through their compensations their greatest strengths and their quality of their shadow, all that they're not seeing, all that's dark, their greatest weakness. It's a double-edged sword. So once I've done that very detailed intake and gone through all their concerns and all their symptoms, and does it get better in heat, and does it get better in cold, does it get better during a season, is it worse with the period, is it better with the period, is it worse when they wake up in the morning, is it better when they get up in the morning, once we've differentiated all that, I want to see how is it embodied. And the pulse will give me where they've been, where they are, where they're going. The pulse gives us the potential to authentically practice Chinese medicine as a preventive form of medicine. Now, we laud Chinese medicine for being preventive, but it's just simply true that most people don't practice that way. Most people don't practice that way. A significant part of the profession is doing triage. And triage is fine for people who don't share the level of good fortune that we have economically. In other words, everyone in this room today is here because you don't have to work to eat today. You're here because you have the money and the free time to be here. You're here because you wanted to be. And that's not true of everybody. Everyone wouldn't have that choice, right? The people who have that choice represent 15% of the planet's culture, right? People in Guatemala earn $5 a month for working 60 hours a week, right? So doing triage is fine at that level. I have a lot of students now in Greece working with Syrian refugees doing triage. They're doing a different kind of medicine. I mean, they've all studied with me and they know how to do all this, but people are getting off boats with hypothermia and there's a different level of medicine you're doing, as you would do if you were working with people who were destitute living in the streets, or mentally ill street people, or people who are just really just needed food. Then you serve them a hot bowl of soup and do some ear acupuncture points, and that's very compassionate. So a significant part of the profession is doing triage. People who aren't doing triage, another significant part of the profession are doing spa treatments. So spa treatments just means like hand-holding, collusion, helping people feel better. People come in, you say, how are you doing? They go, oh, life is hell. I had to drop my kids off at soccer and it barely left me time to get here. And after this, I'm going to be late for my flute lesson. I just know it. You go lay down and you do yin tang and liver 3 and heart 7 and hold the person's hand, turn on the thermal heating pad, hook up a morphine cognac drip, put Yanni on a $49 boombox playing a synthesized shakuhachi flute. And you come back in and go, how are you? And they go, oh, God, maybe it's not so bad. I'll be late to my flute lesson after all. Thank you so much. And then they come back next week and go, that was great. Could we do those same points, do you think? So preventive medicine, you know, the level I'm teaching medicine at and the level I endeavor to practice at, which takes it takes humility to practice at this level, but to do a truly preventive medicine. And the goal in preventive medicine, one, is to remove the person as the source of their own illness, which means the patient has to become the kind of person who doesn't have their problems. And most people aren't willing to do that. Conservative people go to doctors to get drugs and surgery so they can feel better without having to change. And liberals come to acupuncturists, homeopaths, and herbalists so they can feel better without having to change. And we want to, ideally, in terms of prevention, because if we're really practicing a preventive medicine, the person has to become a kind of person who isn't going to engender the future that their pulse is predicting they're going to have if they don't change. And if we use medicine to just help them feel better, but we don't change their beliefs and their behaviors, that those, the dysfunctional beliefs that their dysfunctional behaviors that are hurting them are based on, then you can run but you can't hide from the effect of the karma they're creating in their own lives, right? The beauty of pulse diagnosis, as I teach it, is you can literally see back to the person's time in utero, understand what happened there and what happened since, understand the history that is most likely to have been so to explain the facts sitting in front of you in the chair, speaking to you. And then you can project forward, intuit projecting forward, and understand where that person is most likely to wind up and how quickly, if nothing changes. And then understand what needs to change and how quickly it needs to change if there's a hope of engendering a more whole future. So that's a very high level of medicine. It's a very high level practice of medicine. It's the level of medicine that the classics point us to and inspire us toward, and it's certainly wholly within the grasp of everybody in this room, but it takes serious personal cultivation to do it. It takes, one has to practice in a way that's deadly serious. So everybody's serious is here. I mean, acupuncture school costs too much to not be serious, right? So everybody's serious because you came here on a beautiful day. You could have been out whale watching. Or whatever it is you guys do out here. I live in the Berkshires. We don't whale watch out there. But yeah, you're all here, so you're serious. But the difference between being serious and deadly serious is when you're deadly serious, there's no time in the picture. It means it has to happen. Has to happen. So I'm going to endeavor to transmit this to you this week, and at least a good, strong basis, so that you can appreciate the potential of what pulses can do. Now, pulses aren't really taught in the schools. One reason is not many people know them, really know the pulse. Most of the Asians I've ever seen who work in school clinics, and I teach at all the, well, not all, but I teach at many, if not most, of the schools in the country. In courses like this all year, I teach, 22, 24 weekends a year or something like that. So most of the Asians I've seen who come from China might talk about 28 pulses, but they don't find 28 pulses in clinic. They find bowstring and they find spinning bean and slippery and deep. And that's about it. Tense, which is same as bowstring. Or they might say taut, but that's the same as bowstring. So really they're using about 5 or 6 pulse qualities for the most part. The pulse system I practice has 85 and counting. And so if you say, well, how many qualities are there on the pulse? That would be like saying, how many musical notes are there in a scale? Well, if you play a pentatonic scale, there are 5. But if you play a chromatic scale and you play it up and down the neck, then there might be 80. Right? So, and you have like Balinese microtonal scales with like 120 notes. And if you get on a fretless instrument, like a sitar, well, sitar has frets, but you can, like a fretless guitar, let's say, fretless guitar, fretless bass, infinite. So when you say how many pulse qualities are there, the qualities are just what we can identify, but as you spend time over time, you can subtly make more and more and more and more and more distinctions. I use about 50 qualities every day in my general practice. So the 50 qualities are what you're going to, that's the bread and butter stuff. You're going to see most of that every day. A lot of the other qualities you'd see if you're working on a dialysis ward, but you're not going to see them regularly unless you're working with very, very sick people. There are qualities, for instance, I used to see before the AIDS drugs were invented that I don't see much anymore because I don't see any patients with HIV anymore who aren't on the medications. But before they invented them, when everyone was dying of AIDS, there were qualities that I would routinely see because I ran a free AIDS clinic for 5 years and you would see them. They don't really come into the, you don't see that anymore. So we're going to just differentiate a few qualities this weekend. What we're going to focus on is the overall pulse, taking the pulse with 3 fingers on each hand. That's the main thing we're going to be looking at least for today. But I'm going to send you away with some patterns that you can go right into clinic and start identifying. Okay? And by the way, feel free to raise your hand anytime if there's a question. If I'm teaching you anything that contradicts anything you've learned or that you don't understand, just raise your hand. And it wouldn't be surprising if I taught you things that contradict what you learn. Because learning Chinese medicine, first of all, you can't lecture about anything till you've already taught everything. because everything, anything you learn only makes sense in the context of everything else. And you've learned already that Chinese medicine means being able to hold many conflicting ways of looking at something and knowing which way of looking is contextually true right now in this particular patient in this moment. So is the right proximal pulse heart protector 3-heater? Is it kidney yang? Is it the bladder? Is it kidney yang yin? Is it small intestine? Is it the large intestine? Well, what you have to know is, in this patient right now, given everything else I've seen, this is what it is. But outside the context of individual patients, it's a meaningless distinction. Which is why when people send me these detailed case studies and ask me what to do for their patients, I always go, I don't know. I'm only good when I'm in a room with a person. Then I can do everything. When the patient walks in the room, I can go up, right? But otherwise, it's just hypothetical. It's theoretical. And people put up all the time on Facebook, acupuncturists on Facebook, go, how do you treat chronic schizophrenia? Anyone know good points for that? Oh, it could be a little complex. I have a patient who's bleeding out. I cut their femoral artery. What point should I do? So let's talk about the qualities of a healthy pulse. That's a good place to start. You're probably only going to see this in young people who grow up with a lot of love and good nutrition if there's no Wi-Fi network anywhere near the house. So maybe like in Tibet, in a real high-class family or something. So a healthy pulse is resilient. The icon for a healthy pulse would be bamboo. So bamboo is also the icon of a healthy liver as well, a healthy liver. So what's so unique about bamboo? So we know that the emperor had a bamboo plaque over his throne for thousands of years that said, do nothing. So wu wei means just be, just be. That's because the eunuchs were running everything and the generals were busy doing everything. The emperor's job was propriety, which is 4 times a year on the summer solstice, the emperor would wear red and face south and say the prayer for summer. The emperor worked 4 days a year, and the rest of the time he was just supposed to be. So he worked on the solstices and equinoxes, and the emperor is a metaphor for the pulse, for the heart, which is generating the pulse. So the quality of bamboo is it's deeply rooted. It has profound root structure so that it can bend. So its two main qualities are being rooted, and by virtue of being rooted, it's also hollow. So hollow means empty, which means free of ego. And therefore it has humility, and in the face of wind it can bend, but in the face of bending it's still growing 18 inches a day toward its goal, not losing sight of it. And the more it bends, the more resistance to the wind there is. So on a healthy pulse, the more we push down on it, the wider it gets and the more it pushes back against our finger, because the strength of the pulse is rooted in the depth of the pulse, and the pulse is resilient. As the wind subsides, as we let up our finger pressure, a healthy pulse springs back up. An unhealthy pulse, we press on it, and it's either pounding against our finger, resisting the force, which would be an excess heat, or we push and the whole thing collapses like a house of cards, which would be deficient qi and deficient yang. And tomorrow we're going to look at how does a person become jing deficient by expending yin, and how do they become jing deficient by expending yang, and what are all the pulse qualities that arise as a person goes from a full complement of jing The Tao Te Ching says the infant has a full complement of Jing. Therefore, fierce beasts will not attack it. Wasps will not sting it. It can cry all day without getting hoarse, such is the perfection of its Jing. So how do we go from a state of infancy where Jing is full and the body is resilient to a state of depleted Jing? And how do we get there? Through the path of depleting yin or the path of depleting yang? There are two different paths to Jing deficiency. So one can deplete both, but one will always predominate. In any given individual, there'll be a predomination of yin or yang deficiency by the time a person's Jing deficient. And there are five or six qualities you go through before you get to that. So we'll present that tomorrow. So a healthy pulse, the more we push on it, the wider and wider and stronger it gets. And as we let up pressure, it just comes back and pushes us back to a healthy peak. And the pulse has three depths to it. So it has three depths: qi, blood, and organ. This is the skin. So what I'm inferring here is that a healthy pulse you can't feel by touching a person's skin very lightly. So with no pressure at all on the pulse, there should be nothing coming above the qi depth. If there's something, an impulse that you can feel by just resting your finger, with no pressure. So no pressure means if you took any more energy off the pulse, if you took any more pressure off, you wouldn't physically be touching the person. No pressure means just like this. And then you shouldn't feel an impulse. And if you do, it's pathological. If the pulse feels like it's just floating, that's a floating pulse. A floating pulse is an external pernicious influence, an environmental pathogen coming from the exterior trying to penetrate inwards, and it's just on the surface of the pulse. When you push into it, you can see that it's not part of the radial pulse, and it has no qi, blood, and organ depth. It would be like this. So here's the artery, and it's actually floating on top of the artery, like something like this. So a floating pulse, if it is fast and soft, is wind heat. And if it's hard and slow, it's wind cold. And if it's over the left middle chow, then left middle position, then you would expect wind conditions like headaches and eye twitching and tremors, perhaps wind stroke, like Bell's palsy, if it was very extreme, this sort of thing. If it's over the left proximal position, then perhaps urinary symptoms, bladder infection. If it's over the right distal position, then lung and respiratory and sinus conditions. If it's over the right middle position, then nausea, diarrhea, for instance. If the pulse is coming above the qi depth, but it's rooted, it's coming internally, it can be an internal excess or a relative excess coming from deficiency. An internal excess would be that the organ where you find it is very strong. It has qi and yang to work. There's something it's trying to move and it's pushing hard against it, but it can't move it, the thing it's pushing against. And the thing it's pushing against can be a physiological, physical, material obstruction, like inflammation,
or a kidney stone or a gallstone or stagnant food in the stomach. There's actually physical block. Or it can be an idea or a thought. It can just be the way a person's thinking about their experience and framing it. They did this to me. It usually is associated with victimization. Being a victim of something. Having a construct in your mind you can't move beyond. And people can have a construct in their mind they can't move beyond from the age of 2 to when they die at 115. Without that construct ever moving. So the point is the body's doing work to try to move it, and it can't. And that work creates friction, and that friction creates heat, and that heat is going into the blood and causing the pulse to explode above the chi gap. So that's an internal true excess.
I'm sorry, Lonnie, can you describe that pulse presentation again? I understand.
It's just a wide pulse.
A wide
explode,
pulse.
What we call a tense pulse, which we'll go over tomorrow, exploding above the chi gap. You can also have yin deficiency, which means the heat persisted so long, it consumed fluid, and now the person is yin deficient, and there's not enough yin to root the yang, and the yang is exploding away. It's not a true excess anymore, it's coming from the deficiency. And with the first person, you would give them papyrum-based herbs with gardenia and mudan pea, or gypsum, some very cooling herb. You give some because it's a real strong excess and you're giving them something very cold to cool the blood or cool digestion. You understand? With the second person who's yin deficient with the heat exploding, the third, if you gave them those strong heat clearing herbs, it would hurt them. They're yin deficient, you have to now tonify yin. Okay. A healthy pulse, however, has a broad base and a narrower top. As I push down on it, it gets wider and wider and wider. And as I let up, it gets increasingly more narrow. And it brings me all the way back up to the chi depth. The chi depth of the entire pulse, when I'm taking the pulse with 3 fingers on each hand, like this, the chi presence of the chi depth is the communal store of chi. When I teach in Rothenburg, Germany, there's a conference there every year. It's the coolest acupuncture conference in the world. It's in a walled city, which is the oldest walled city castle in Europe. It was so beautiful, the Allies didn't bomb it, so they gave the Germans. They said, your town's so beautiful, we don't want to destroy it. We'll give you 72 hours to kill all the Nazis. Not a bad strategy, really. and they did that, and they got killed all the Nazis, and now there's an acupuncture conference there for a week every year. So when I teach there, the grand teaching hall, they have 700 acupuncturists show up to this town, and all the classes are in castle rooms looking out over landscapes. It's beautiful. The main teaching hall that accommodates 700 people is the town where the town stored grain. So all the farmers had to contribute enough grain every year so that if there was a drought, the whole community could live for 3 years. And if there was a siege, everyone could come inside the castle walls and live for 3 years. That's what the chi depth of the pulse is. The presence of the chi depth on the whole pulse or for any specific organ indicates that, when organs, when they work, consume resources, right? So for the liver to run its 500 enzymatic reactions, or for the spleen to spleen, or the lung to breathe, or any organ to work, it has to consume Ji, Qing, and Shen, and Yin and Yang, right? It's consuming these things to work, but the presence of the Qi depth means alchemy has happened. And in the consuming of resources, something has been elevated and given back to the entire organism for all the organs to use. The difference between cultivational techniques like yoga, meditation, tai chi, qigong, and aerobic kind of exercises where you just use your willpower to do them is when you're done using doing an exercise that required willpower, you have less resources than you started with, and the body is stronger on the outside. The outside of you is stronger, but you're weaker internally. And when you cultivate, you grow stronger internally and the outside grows softer. And not just the outside of the body, but the in terms of joy and gratitude and the humility and the virtues coming through the personality. The self gets softer on the outside, but stronger and more soul depth and spiritual self-confidence internally. So we can see that in terms of the presence of the chi depth. We can extend that metaphor, and we can say when the organs are cultivating, they're using resources but transmuting them and contributing chi to the overall organism. When the chi depth is absent in an individual organ system, it means that it's working, but it's not giving back. It's a hole that resources are leaking out through. It's consuming but not giving. Consuming but not giving. And when the chi depth is absent from the entire pulse, that's a concern. And so tomorrow we'll be talking all about, we'll talk a lot about that. The blood depth of the pulse is both blood and chi. It's both blood and chi. If there's time, we'll get through the blood depth of the pulse tomorrow too. Although it isn't advertised, but miraculously, I've learned to give this class pretty efficiently, so hopefully I'll do that this weekend. Last time I gave it in Berkeley, I finished 2 hours early, so we just used all that for exercises. So we're going to try to leave time every day for practicum, and Amy Jo will be taking a group of 20, and I'll deal with a group of 20, and we'll try to spend at least an hour every day doing practical, maybe more. So this is chi and blood. Depth is chi and blood. Why do I call it chi? Well, you still need chi to raise the pulse up through the blood depth. So when the blood depth is absent, there's blood deficiency, but even more chi deficiency than there is blood deficiency. And the organ depth of the pulse, one more thing to say about blood. So the pulse that speaks more to blood deficiency is the thin pulse. And a thin pulse is a very thin pulse that's also soft. Okay? Now that person is blood deficient in Chinese medicine, a person with bilaterally thin pulse. If you want to feel what the thin pulse looks like, take the pulse of vegetarians in your clinic. Particularly women who've been vegetarians all their life, up to the age of like 45. Because after 45, when they become perimenopausal and then menopausal, they'll also become yin deficient and the pulse will tighten up because of the yin deficiency. But in their 20s and 30s and early 40s, the pulse will be bilaterally thin. Also, most people with eating disorders have a thin pulse from the malnutrition. We'll spend quite a bit of time on that this morning, too. The blood depth. So you can get a person with a bilaterally thin pulse. That means blood deficiency, but they won't be anemic. And the reason they're not anemic is because in Western medicine, we look at mineral content of the blood, and in Chinese medicine, we look at nutritive content of the blood. When we talk about blood deficiency in Chinese medicine, we're not talking about hemoglobin, we're talking about yin, Y-I-N-G, which is nutritive content of the blood. Yin is yellow energy, and when yin goes through the heart puts its seal of approval on it, and that turns it into blood and makes it red. The heart puts spirit, so the blood conducts spirit. Yin is the nutritive content of the blood. When that nutritive content goes through the heart invests Shen in it, and then the blood becomes red. So blood is consciousness. which is why when there's blood deficiency or blood can't get to the periphery because of counterflow qi, then you get numbness. You're getting numbness, not in the West we'd say, well, poor blood circulation, and that's true, but from a Chinese standpoint, it's because Shen, consciousness, isn't being transmitted via the blood into the periphery. So now the organ depth of the pulse is the store of Jing and Yuanqi. Okay? So Jing and Yuanqi, Yuanqi is source Qi, and Jing is genetic, right? Jing is potential. It's the foundation of Qi blood and yin and yang. It's the foundation of Qi blood, yin and yang. So Yuanqi is two, yin and yang, but Jing is one. Yuanqi is two, Jing is one. So it's the root. So we want a person to have a healthy organ depth of the pulse. That tells us there's reserve. So we're going to be talking much more about these three depths when we go through the different continuums tomorrow. I just want you to understand the healthy pulse rises up to the finger. It rises up. We can feel it coming. It hits the finger. And it diminishes and goes away. Okay? A healthy pulse has an impulse that's rising and falling and also goes laterally like this. So the waveform is coming like this. And there are two vectors. One is rising and falling. One is going laterally. When the rising and falling vector diminishes significantly, so that most of what we feel is a lateral movement, so instead of feeling this, this is healthy. Instead of feeling this, if I start just feeling this, no rising and falling, that's what a slippery pulse is. Slippery is a pulse that's not going like this so much. It's just coming by sideways. Slippery means damp. It means turbulence. It means turbulence wherever you find it. And the most frequent cause of turbulence is dampness in the blood caused by lipids. It's not the only cause. You can have immunizations, infections, but on average, lipids. When the lateral component disappears, and the pulse is just going like this, back and forth over the same material over and over and over again, the person is overthinking and tends to have a deep, morbid infatuation with their own thoughts and their own emotional state. They're spinning their, this is just, you're in a tractor and you're spinning your wheels in mud and it's sinking deeper and deeper and deeper. And you're not going anywhere. You got your foot on the gas and the whole thing is just going down in the damp. So it's just worry and obsession, which is the emotion associated with earth.
Okay.
So,
good to go another half an hour before break? All right. There it is. I didn't recognize this. Must be. It's the high speed racing. Okay. We're going to talk about now the left and the right side of the pulse. And I'm going to give you five different patterns on the pulse. These are patterns that you discern, again, just like this. You can just literally touch a person's pulse, sit down, just sit down, three fingers on each side of the pulse over the radial artery. When you're taking pulse this way, when I take pulse this way, I'm not thinking,
heart, liver, kidney, lung, spleen, kidney, yang. You drop all that. You might see something, but forget it. This is just looking at whole pulse, just looking at the attribute of the whole pulse. And then I want to look at the whole pulse, see what's there, and then I want to look at left side and right side of the pulse to compare the two to each other. So we're going to go over five syndrome patterns that you can discern the second you sit down with someone just by putting your three fingers on each hand over the pulse. Okay, the left side of that graph is the left pulse, and the right side is the right pulse. What's your name?
Jody.
Jody.
So this section, does it correlate to any of the diagrams in the handout necessarily? Or?
It'd be nice if it did, wouldn't it? I made this on a Commodore Amiga in 1991, so. I think I can definitively say no, it does not. Consider this bonus material. I'll make one for the next class. Gotta go get my Amiga out of here. Okay. This is just very quick here. Okay? This is the left side of the pulse, right? So in other words, kidney, liver, heart. And this is the right side of the pulse. In other words, pericardium, three-heater, or kidney, yang, spleen, lung. How do we understand the left and right side of the pulse? This is a broad overview. The left side of the pulse is the ascent of the Hun spirit. There are three Hun, and the Hun, I would say, is the highest emanation of the Jing, Qi, Shen. So we have Jing in water, Qi in liver, Shen in fire, the three treasures. During our life, at the moment of conception, spirit incarnates into the vehicle. And over the course of life, that fire ideally ascends. The life force is a force that's pushing every moment up the spine toward higher and higher and higher centers. And each center has different and higher capacities, and all the capacities of each successive center include all the previous capacities but transcend them and have a broader view and a wider embrace. As consciousness ascends up the spine, there's an increased capacity to identify other as self. The higher the fire goes, the higher consciousness evolves, the more we recognize what we thought was other as self. It's a very simplistic way to put it, but it gets it nicely.
Melania, are you saying then as we evolve, we have a greater capacity for empathy, or is that the self is becoming...
Yeah, that's one way to put it. But empathy can still imply, like, empathy for one. If it's empathy for an other, I'm saying that the higher it goes, this actually transcends the sense of other. And a greater recognition of self as all. Okay? So we can think of wood as a tree, and it's sending roots down into the kidney. So liver one to kidney one, liver one to kidney one. And then it's stretching toward the sun, its uppermost branches. And then We have the heart open as the lotus opens. Wood supports fire. The heart opens and there's recognition. And at the moment of death, the hood ascends through GV20 to the North Star. GV20 is the physiological embodiment of the North Star. One of the first, I think the second article, third article I ever published in Chinese medicine was on GV20 and the creation myths around it. So at the moment of death, the spirit, the liver spirit, the hun, goes through GV20 to the North Star to report on the merit you accrued in this lifetime. In other words, heaven invested light in us at the moment of conception. Are we returning more? Have we elevated it? Has that light been elevated in our incarnation? Or did we just consume? How much came back? Did heaven make interest? Or did we just, you know, eat and screw? to be blunt. I used to not say things like that, but I'm trying to loosen up a little bit. But people can relate. So. Okay. So the philosophical question for the left-hand pulses is, how is it through conducting physiology, how is it through the vehicle of the human body, is it possible to create light? You just have this thing. You have this thing, and it's going through a life, and yet it can cultivate light. It can create light. How is that possible? So how is it through Jing, Qi, and Shen, is it possible for us to actually create light? And there's an opposing force, and that opposing force is that every moment of life, heaven is sending us light. And we're assimilating that light through our digestive system. The only source of nourishment from first breath onward is light. So the whole function of the digestive system is to abstract light from air, water, and food. So the Buddhist texts and the Taoist texts, if you're studying Qigong and Tai Chi or meditation, tell us to ingest the light from the moon and the stars and the sun. The character for Shen is heaven, earth, moon, stars, sun. With two hands, lowering a rope. This on the right here is the character for electricity, lightning bolt. Boom. Wake up. The light, heaven, earth, moon, star, sun. One, two, three. That's cosmology. So the genesis of the universe from the one to the two to the three are for the sake of transmission of light, like a lightning bolt, electricity, life force, consciousness being transmitted. That light is invested within our Jing at the moment of conception. The light is invested within the Jing at the moment of conception and rises through us. And we tend to get conditioned, forget who we are, and we just take that light and use it and become more and more embedded where we already are. So there is emptiness, there's an explosion coming out of emptiness, there's an original trauma, the ego, the sense of self as separate is developed with all its psychological complexity and victimization. That's the thing we all think that we're in a process of getting over, but for most of us, while we're working getting over it, we're just doing it growing this way. And there's this emptiness, which is zero, and this explosion coming out of it of light straight up the spine, which is plus one. And when there's a trauma, we take that life force and we pursue substitute gratifications. Substitute gratifications for what? Substitute gratifications for unity. Substitute gratifications for oneness and recognition of self as the one. Self as one. Self as unity. We get involved with substitute gratifications and we stop developing, and this represents the energy getting fixed at some chakra somewhere, usually ego or prior. So if you're wounded at the first chakra, you're autistic, and second chakra, you're psychotic, and third chakra, you're neurotic, and fourth chakra, you're at best a well-functioning, healthy-functioning ego. Should be like Tony Robbins. Right? Like and Jack LaLanne, like really like well-functioning, integrated, independent, separate self, and you support everybody else's right to be a well-functioning, separate, independent, separate self. But the energy has stopped rising there and gotten blocked, and that blockage is going to cause stasis, and it's going to cause things to grow. So the point is to keep going. And beyond that, we have the psychic, the subtle, the causal, and the non-dual realms, which people tend to see in higher state experiences. And the point would be to not just see them, but to become stabilized there. When we get embedded at a particular place, there's this relentless force of energy still trying to rectify itself, shoving itself this way. And simultaneously, life is sending us light every moment, trying to disembed us from where we got stuck. And that's a process of digestion. And the entire process of making what we've relegated to our unconscious known, so everything we've buried, everything we've suppressed, being willing to see our shadow and bringing it into awareness and bringing light to it so we can learn from it is a process of digestion. And that's the right side of the cycle. The outer aspect of digestion is creating muscle and blood to build ourselves a body. The inner aspect is to eat away at the core of our beliefs so we can let go of them and then keep developing and keep growing and not land anywhere, but keep going. So this is the Po, and the original use of the word Po in Chinese language is for the phase of the moon where it's becoming increasingly light. The Po are the bacteria in your intestines, the dark place you don't want to look or have anything to do with. And those bacteria are down there digesting the feces, extracting ATP, energy from them, extracting light from the dark and cleaning and bringing consciousness to what isn't seen, revealing shadow in the depth. And when that is repressed and conditioned by ego, we just become consumers, just eating, and obtaining material goods and having sex and eating and consuming just for the sake of that as a substitute gratification without letting go. And at the moment of death, the Po goes out the anus, and it is a metaphor for all that we would not face in life that becomes fertilizer for our next round of incarnation. Sir, you had a question. What's your name?
Chris.
Yeah, Chris.
If I'm understanding this correctly, the digestion is being used as a way to bring light back into areas that are stuck for us.
And digestion, thought is the spirit of the stomach and spleen, yi, right? So the character thought is a pedestal, which means to establish something. It's li. It means to establish. And if I establish it with words, now I have the character yin, as in pinyin, which means music or sound. And if I put that over the heart, it's the sound, thought is the sound that the spleen offers the heart. Okay? Thought is the digestive aspect of the mind. So the mind serves, as the stomach serves to break down everything that you ingest into a homogeneous whole. So the small intestine can take the minerals and the amino acids in, and the colon can assimilate the minerals, and then everything else can be let go of. The function of thought is to take your life experience and break it down so you can learn what the meaning was in what happened and let go of your attachment to the rest of it. And obsession, which is the pathological emotion associated with birth, shows us the skull. So that's a skull with the sutures on the skull, and it's also a field, a farming field. It's the field of thought over the heart, and the pathological emotion of earth is worry, obsession, just going over and over the same thought. You're not nourishing yourself with the thought. You're just thinking, thinking, thinking the same thing over and over again.
So when you have an issue with digestion, which can reflect with the issues with obsessive thinking and thought, is that a representation of the area that somebody's stuck in, or is that almost seen as a separate issue that needs to be addressed so that the person can get back to being nourished and not being stuck?
Well, that's what you have to diagnose. So you can have issues which are physical, that are impacting emotions and impacting the mind, which are blocking spirit. And you can have issues which are karmic and unseen, that are filtering out to and causing bad habits, because a person is suing a substitute gratification that is causing problems in the body. So you always have to look at what level and what dimension of the self is any particular problem coming from. Right? I mean, for instance, if I went out and ate a lobster right now, I'd have digestive problems for 3 weeks. And it wouldn't point to any great problem with me psychologically or emotionally just because I ate a lobster for demonstration purposes in the class. Do you understand? So this is what we have to sort out. Someone else?
Yeah,
what's your name?
Jessica.
Jessica?
Enjoying your class very much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Just getting going.
Great. I'm wondering about, though, when digestion is affected by an environmental pathogen, I could say, or mold, say.
Sure.
House.
Yeah.
This did happen to me, and I ended up getting very damaged in my digestion.
Yeah.
So.
But wasn't your thinking fuzzy? Didn't you have, like, brain fog? Yeah, so it was impacting your mind, which the Chinese would call spirit.
And digest the whole.
Yeah.
And the digestion. So how would this work with the digestiveness? I mean, it makes you more obsessive, more.
Yeah.
And I mean also,
well, I mean, any good practitioner would just say you have to live in a different place.
Yeah, because it changed everything I eat. I can't eat much, you know. I mean,
okay.
Many things.
No, but that particular kind of question is more complex. I mean, what I'm doing here is just setting up so you understand the left and right side of the pulse.
Right.
But I mean,
thinking ahead, medicine, how does medicine affect people? How does that change their spiritual journey?
Well, don't you think that would be like a big question?
Yeah.
I mean, we could do 2 days just on that. Okay, yeah.
Thank you. I have a very quick
and
question.
Your name?
Oh, sorry, my name's Lauren.
Lauren, okay.
And also, did you went through a list of blockages through the chakras, and I just didn't write quick enough. Could you do it one more time?
A list of blockages.
What I said is,
first chakra's autistic, second chakra's psychotic, third chakra's neurotic, fourth would just be having a horribly inflated ego, like me. Fifth would be psychic. And psychic doesn't just mean, you know, the capacity for higher intuition, deeper intuition. The next chakra, the sixth chakra, is the subtle realm, which would be all the Hindu deities and Tibetan deities and all the stuff you'd see if you took ayahuasca, all those kind of spirits. And then the seventh would be Causal would be Vipassana meditation. So you meditate and the instructions are to watch thoughts, feelings, emotions, and sensations arise and fall away. And you've placed yourself at the portal between being and non-being, and you can see that everything is constructed, the self is constructed, and that thoughts, feelings, emotions, and sensations have no self nature. And then the eighth chakra is hard to talk about because you're not there.
Thank you so much.
So that the eighth would be what Lao Tzu is pointing at when he says in the first line of the Tao Te Ching, the Tao that can be talked about is not the eternal Tao. Because it's just, there's no experience of it. If you're describing an experience and you're saying there are oceans, and there's nothing but love, the whole universe is a raging fire, the whole universe is consciousness, and there's nothing that's not conscious, and there's nothing that isn't love, and that's all that's true, there's still a you seeing it. So that's seventh chakra. And eighth is just this mystery. It's hard to talk about.
Thank you so much.
Maybe not just hard, maybe impossible. Because Lao Tzu couldn't do it, so we should be humble, right? So the issue for the left half of the cycle is how is it through the operation of a body do you make light? But for the right half of the cycle, which is the digestive system, the pericardium is digesting relationship. The spleen and stomach are digesting food, and the lungs are digesting air and moisture. So the right side is the digestive system, and the mystery for the right side is, how is it out of light do you construct a body? If all that's coming to you is light, how do you make bone, muscle, and brain out of light? And then for the left half, it's out of the workings of that body, how is it that light is elevated? So we have this reciprocal relationship of light invested at the Jing at conception, raising throughout a lifetime, up a person's spine and out the top of their head to engender wisdom. And then we have every moment of life, a breathing and an eating and an assimilation through the sensory orifices of light, and we're building a body out of it. So those are the two halves of the cycle. So that is a brief philosophical introduction to the two sides of the pulse. Why don't we take a break for 10 minutes, and then when we come back, we'll do these five syndrome patterns that involve the two sides of the pulse.